You see it everywhere. Its iconic fenestrated leaves grace trendy cafes, glossy magazines, and countless social media feeds. The Monstera deliciosa, the Swiss cheese plant, has become an undeniable icon of modern houseplant culture. But what you might not know is that this seemingly ubiquitous symbol of aesthetic goals has a story that's far more intriguing, baffling, and dangerously deceptive than is usually discussed. I'm Megan Brehm, and on this episode of The History of Plants, we're unearthing the surprising story of this wild jungle native whose meteoric rise from resourceful jungle climber to coveted symbol that is the equivalent to the tulip mania of the modern world. Part one, A Jungle Secret. The Monstera's incredible discovery begins not in ancient temples or royal courts, but deep in time itself. Its lineage is part of the Araceae family, better known as aroids, making it a cousin to philodendrons, anthuriums, and calla lilies, amongst others. This family is a historian's dream. It has one of the oldest and most continuous fossil records among angiosperms, flowering plants, starting in the early Cretaceous period, which is approximately 122 to 128 million years ago. The family diversified around the same time as the final stages of the breakup of the supercontinent Pangaea, divvying into 8 subfamilies, of which Monsterioideae is one. We found fossilized pollen that links to the actual ancestral line of Monstera in Portugal dating back 100 million years. As Pangaea fragmented into the northern continent of Laurasia and the southern continent of Gondwana, populations of these early aroids became geographically isolated. This is a process known as vicariance. It's a separation of a once continuous population by a geographic barrier and is the primary engine of these plants' evolutions, forcing direct lineages to adapt to new isolated environments. Our plant, Monstera deliciosa, settled into the lush tropical rainforests that stretch from modern-day southern Mexico to Panama, most likely around 60 million years ago based on fossilized pollen grains we found in modern-day Colombia. For a plant that is so visibly prominent and biologically successful in the very heartlands of the great Mesoamerican civilizations, Monstera deliciosa presents a perplexing cultural mystery because it is pretty much a ghost in the historical records. Stay with me on this because it gets a little weird. The Aztecs and the Maya, cultures that meticulously documented their worlds, seem to have left it almost entirely out of their grand narratives. An extensive review of known archaeological evidence reveals a conspicuous void, which is just baffling to me. There is no definitive, agreed-upon depictions of its uniquely fenestrated leaves or distinctive fruit in the surviving murals, stone carvings, or pictorial manuscripts of these empires, not even in the famous Florentine Codex. This absence is made all the more puzzling by the rich botanical iconography that does exist. These cultures celebrated and immortalized the plants central to their economy and cosmology. Detailed representations of maize, cacao, and squash are really common. And digging into the puzzles like this one, unearthing the full story behind a plant you thought you knew, is exactly what we do here in every episode. So if that sounds like your kind of thing, it's probably a good time to hit that subscribe button. So why would a culture ignore a plant with such a dramatic appearance? The solution may lie not in what the plant was, but in what it wasn't. The plants depicted in sacred and elite art were typically those with profound spiritual significance or high status economic value, like cacao or the vanilla orchid, which we covered in a previous episode. The evidence of Monstera's use, however, points overwhelmingly towards the practical and the mundane. You see, its value was in its strong fibers and its occasional delicious fruits, placing it firmly in a category was essentially workhorse plants. The secret, then, is not that it was hidden, but that it was hiding in plain sight. Perhaps it was just too common and too functional to be worthy of sacred illustration. While it may be a ghost in the elite art of the past, we still know Monstera deliciosa was a vital presence in the daily lives of the indigenous peoples of Mexico and Central America. The most celebrated use was culinary. When fully ripe, the fruit, known locally as piña nona, tastes like a mix of pineapple, mango, and banana. Beyond its fruit, the plant's most important contribution was its strong, pliable aerial roots. In Mexico, these were skillfully woven into durable baskets. In Peru, they were processed into strong, reliable ropes. This plant also held a place in traditional pharmacopoeia. In Mexico, a root infusion was used to treat arthritis, while in Martinique, the root was a remedy for snake bites. And in Brazil, mashed and warmed leaves were applied to wounds to cauterize them. The story of the Monstera's formal documentation by Western science is a a tangled vine, putting it nicely, of competing claims benefiting its mysterious character. While some researchers have pointed to carvings in 11th century Hindu temples as evidence of pre-Columbian contact, this theory, it's not widely accepted by mainstream archaeology. The Spanish conquistadors, who, granted, were more interested in gold and high-value commodities than botany, still took time to send documentation and samples of other plants that they thought would be significant to Spain's economy and, it seems, largely overlooked our Monstera. A catastrophic fire in 1671 at the Escorial Palace in Spain then destroyed what was likely the most comprehensive survey of New World plants, potentially taking any early records of the Monstera with it. The plant's definitive scientific debut was, therefore, erased. The first clear documented description that gave us the name we use today, Monstera deliciosa, came in 1841 from the Danish botanist Frederick Michael Liebmann, who was studying a specimen from Mexico. But at the same time, another collector, Josef Barshevik, had found it in Guatemala, highlighting a period of intense botanical discovery where everyone was scrambling to claim the next big find. Regardless of who you heard it from, once it got into collectors' hands, the Monstera finally got its flowers. By the 1870s, it was documented in Singapore and India, then moving over into China, where it was integrated into traditional Chinese medicine. It also put down roots in tropical islands like Hawaii, where it thrived so well, it eventually became an invasive nuisance. For all its globetrotting, one colossal gap in the historical record remains. Despite having countless ideal climates where Monstera could flourish, the trail goes cold in Africa. We find no trace of it on the continent's rich medicinal or folkloric traditions, which to me is a little weird because, once again, we have excellent documentation of how other plants were used by African tribes. I mean, heck, I've covered them here on past episodes. It went all the way to China, and yet not one single person plopped one down in Africa? Maybe I'm being a little pedantic, but my point is, yet once again, all we have is one more mystifying silence in the story of Monstera's global journey. But I digress, because this is where it gets really good. And so, the Monstera deliciosa arrived on the world stage, a survivor, a workhorse, a ghost from the past, and was now finding its home in parlors and greenhouses around the globe. But as it spread, it carried its most profound secrets in plain sight. The very features that would make it a design icon, those awesome dramatic leaves, aren't an aesthetic choice. They're a complex code, a biological cipher, essentially, that tells a story of light, of danger, and of transformation. Part 2, a leafy enigma. To unlock the secrets of the Monstera, we have to go back to the literal end of the world for some species. 66 million years ago, an asteroid strike triggered an impact winter, plunging the planet into darkness and wiping out the dinosaurs. But deep in the forest understory, the Monstera's ancestors survived. Their secret weapon was a pre-adaptation for the shadows, an ability to thrive in low-light conditions that gave them a critical edge when the sun vanished. This evolutionary inheritance is the key to understanding everything that makes this plant so unique today. And I'm going to pick up my Thai constellation again so we can dive into it. The first trick is a masterpiece of counterintuitive survival. A Monstera seedling begins its life with a curious gamut because it shuns the light. This strategy, known as scototropism, compels the young plant to crawl across the forest floor in search of darkness. In the dense jungle, the darkest shape is almost always the base of a massive tree, the very ladder it needs to reach the life-giving canopy. If you think about it, this turns the plant from a passive organism into an active hunter, creature of the shadows, seeking a host to conquer its vertical world. Once it makes contact, its second secret weapon is deployed, a sophisticated dual root system. It maintains an earthly connection with subterranean roots that draw nutrients from the soil, while at the same time producing long, cord-like aerial roots. These aerial roots are marvels of adaptation, anchoring the vine securely to its host, while also absorbing moisture and nutrients from the humid air. This anatomy makes Monstera a hemi-epiphyte, a nomadic climber, part earthbound, part tree dweller, capable of ascending over 60 feet into the rainforest canopy. And it's there, high above the forest floor, that the plant's most famous feature presents a new puzzle, the fenestrations. These iconic holes aren't just for style. The leading theory is a case of brilliant light economics. A massive solid leaf would cast lower parts of the plant into total darkness. So the theory is that the holes act like skylights, allowing precious rays of sun to filter down, ensuring the whole organism gets a share of light. But there's another side to this plant's ingenuity. a darker secret hinted in its name. Its primary defense is a sophisticated and brutal two-stage attack. The plant cells are loaded with microscopic needle-shaped crystals of calcium oxalate called raphides. These are bundled inside specialized ejector cells called ideoblasts, which act like microscopic cannons. When the plant tissue is crushed or chewed, ideoblasts rupture, forcefully firing these crystalline darts into the sensitive tissues of the attacker's mouth and throat. But the assault doesn't stop there. This initial mechanical damage creates pathways for secondary chemical attack, allowing other irritants in the sap, like proteolytic enzymes, to penetrate the wounds, triggering intense pain, swelling, and a burning sensation likened to eating fiberglass. I don't know who had to liken it to that, but clearly someone did. This presents the ultimate poison paradox. How can a monster also be delicious? The solution is a slow and deliberate act of botanical alchemy. Over the course of the year, as the fruit matures, enzymes within it neutralize the oxalic acid and break down the needle-like crystals. The hexagonal scales of the fruit fall away, revealing the edible, fragrant pulp beneath. A sweet reward, but only for those patient enough to wait for the plant to disarm itself. It's this same complex chemistry, private apothecary of bioactive compounds, that gives the plant its medicinal power. I have to set it down. I'm allergic to mold in the soil, and it's starting to make me itchy. The presence of these anti-inflammatory flavonoids and steroids offer a scientific rationale for its traditional use as an arthritis remedy in Mexico and its application in folk remedies against the swelling from Fertilanz snake bites in Martinique. The astringent tannins and antimicrobial alkaloids explain its use in Brazil for healing wounds. And in traditional Chinese medicine, it was used to treat fevers, coughs, and infections, which is essentially a cross-cultural testament to its potent healing secrets that are hidden within this leafy enigma. Now, with a resume like that, a prehistoric survivor, a master climber, a toxic defender that offers a delicious reward, it's no wonder that humans would eventually fall under its spell. But the story of its rise to fame wasn't a straight climb to the top. It was a volatile cycle of mania, neglect, and explosive resurgence. Part 3, Monstera Madness. Every icon has a breakout moment, right? For the Monstera Deliciosa, its first real taste of fame didn't happen in a scientist's lab. It happened in shag-carpeted, macrame-filled living rooms from the 1970s. This was the decade it went from botanical specimen to cultural superstar. It was the undisputed icon of the jungle look, which was an interior design trend that favored lush, abundant greenery. Amidst the macrame hangers, the shag carpets, and earthy tones, avocado fridges, and the like, the Monstera with its huge, dramatic leaves was the ultimate statement piece. It was like a living sculpture in the corner of every cool apartment, a symbol of the growing desire to bring the wildness of nature indoors. Fame is fickle, and the backlash was swift. The 1980s arrived, draped in chintz florals and giant shoulder pads, pushing the organic vibe of the 70s aside. Then the 1990s came and delivered a final stylistic knockout. The Monstera was suddenly a plant without a home, too lush and unruly for the decades rising tide of sleek minimalism, and far too polished to fit in with the gritty anti-style aesthetic of the grunge movement. This trend shifted towards the clean lines of things like orchids or the simple reliability of a ficus tree. The once glamorous Monstera was relegated to the background as a relic of a bygone decade. Just kind of funny to think, like, plants becoming trendy and not trendy, you know? After two decades in the design wilderness, though, the Monstera's revival began, but not in print, online. Its comeback was architected by a new generation. Starting in the mid-2010s, millennials and Gen Z embraced the plant-parent identity, driven by a wellness movement to bring nature back indoors. On visual platforms like Instagram, the Monstera was the perfect protagonist. It was graphic, it was photogenic, and was so full of personality. You might remember that this digital wave became a tsunami during the COVID-19 pandemic. When the world was stuck at home, we turned to houseplants for comfort and connection. So the Monstera wasn't just revived, it was reborn as an icon. This intense cultural spotlight ignited an essentially Monstera mania, becoming a speculative bubble with startling parallels to the tulip mania of the 17th century. The new holy grail was variegation, a rare genetic mutation that creates stunning patterns on the leaves. The prices for prized cultivars of Monstera Deliciosa became astronomical, reaching their peak with what is believed to be the highest recorded sale for a single plant. A unique cultivar named the Devil Monster sold at the Bangkok International Plant Show for 1.4 million baht, or approximately 39,000 US dollars. One plant. More than a car. While this was a record for a single plant, the broader market was still as feverish. Small, single-leaf cuttings of other prized cultivars like the Alba Variegata or the Mint were fetching hundreds of dollars. The economics were driven by scarcity and hype. Unstable variegation like that of the Alba can only be propagated by slow, uncertain stem cuttings. In contrast, the stable Thai Constellation was developed in a lab via tissue culture. While now you can find them in nearly any plant store today, back then, its production was tightly controlled, keeping prices artificially high for years. While I didn't pay hundreds of dollars for my Thai Constellation, I definitely remember paying more than the 20 that you can get them for now. It was a perfect storm of rarity, social media influence, and a captive audience stuck inside, creating a speculative market where a single plant could be worth more than a car. This explosion in popularity from a dusty relic to a digital superstar has firmly cemented the Monstera in our culture. But this global embrace isn't without its consequences. When a plant becomes this famous, this commodified, it casts a long shadow, one that stretches from the auction block right back to the ecosystems it sometimes threatens. Part 4, the price of popularity. But the story of the Monstera's value doesn't end with a $39,000 price tag. There are other costs to consider, ecological and ethical ones that are not tallied on an invoice. And while this story doesn't involve a secret orchid trade or a high-stakes conservation battle, the Monstera deliciosa is far too prolific to currently be endangered. Its global popularity comes with a different, more complicated price. The first is a direct consequence of the very traits we admire. The incredible resilience and adaptability that allowed Monstera to survive an asteroid and master the jungle make it a formidable competitor. When introduced to new tropical climates, it can escape cultivation and run wild. In places like Hawaii and Ascension Island, the Monstera has become an invasive species. Free from the natural checks and balances of its ecosystem, it can smother native flora, altering the delicate balance of the forests it invades. The ultimate survivor, in the wrong context, can become a threat. The second cost leads us down one of the more fascinating puzzles in this plant's modern story. Value. So the plant began as a vital workhorse for indigenous people in Mesoamerica, but today its DNA is the foundation of a multi-million dollar global industry. This journey is a classic example of what's known as bioprospecting, which is the process of turning a region's natural resources into commercial products. The historical spread of the Monstera happened long before our modern rules, but it still encourages us to ask some thought-provoking and potentially uncomfortable questions. What is the relationship between the plant's original utility and its modern aesthetic value? Doing all of my research for this episode, it really kind of, I had to sit with it and think for a while. This Monstera madness has helped fuel a houseplant industry whose environmental impact is larger than we might imagine. The sheer scale of production has hidden costs, the non-renewable peat moss that is used in soil mixes, the endless cycle of single-use plastic pots, and the carbon footprint of shipping tropical plants around the globe. And admittedly, you know, I am part of that problem too. The very act of bringing nature indoors when multiplied by millions can put a strain on nature itself. So the Monstera deliciosa sits at the center of a modern paradox, pretty much. It's a plant that connects us to the wild, yet its journey reveals the complexities of our global economy. But before you think I'm asking you to chuck your Monsteras and possibly your subscription to this series, let me be clear. This knowledge is not a burden. It's an opportunity. Not judging you, nothing to be ashamed about. Understanding the full story, its prehistoric survival, the indigenous roots, the scientific marvels, the cycles of fame, and the hidden costs allows us to see this plant for what it truly is, a living piece of history. It elevates it from a simple decoration to a profound conversation piece. And perhaps the best way to honor its incredible journey is to simply be a conscious steward, to appreciate the deep story behind the leaves, and in doing so, find an even richer connection to the piece of the wild that we have invited into our homes. I'm Megan Brame. Thank you for joining me on another episode of The History of Plants. Jump into the commentary episode on Patreon or check out the video version on my YouTube channel, Plantrums. Until next time, greenies, stay curious and don't forget to flourish.